Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have news on two landmark Supreme Court rulings, one legalizing gay marriage nationwide and the other upholding the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare subsidies in all 50 states. Plus, hear about a vote in the U.S. Senate to fast-track a controversial trade pact. We'll also have news on a national controversy over the Confederate flag in the wake of a black church massacre in South Carolina, and some startling results of our own East County Magazine special investigation into hate crimes right here in San Diego County. Also hear about a Black Lives Matter rally in Lemon Grove, new fire trucks rolling out in our rural areas, wildfires burning in four western states, and a warning from CAL FIRE about the worst wildfire conditions on record here in California. Fire danger is high locally this weekend, with thunderstorms forecast to bring lightning strikes and gusty winds in our mountain areas, plus possible flash flooding, so be careful out there. On Destination East County, hear about some fun summer events from Julian's Gold Rush Days to the 4th of July celebrations coming up and more. And then on Green Scene, learn about the Pope's call for a worldwide effort to fight climate change. On Bookshelf, Rana Menashe interviews author Sherry Kephart about her adventures around the world and her inspirational story of overcoming adversity, as well as news about her participation in a memoirs conference this weekend. Our newsmaker interviews today are with visitors from the Philippines who are here with the U.S. State Department's International Leadership Program. They've been traveling across the U.S. studying ways to combat political corruption, including a visit here in San Diego, and we'll tell you what they've learned. So stay tuned for these stories and more on the East County Magazine show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. In a historic ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court majority has ruled that same-sex marriage is legal in all 50 states, protected under the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. President Barack Obama likened the historic decision to justice that arrives like a thunderbolt, declaring, "When all Americans are treated as equal, we are all more free." The High Court, ruling in the Obergefell v. Hodges case, was asked to decide two issues. Can individual states ban same-sex marriage, and must all states honor same-sex marriages for weddings performed in other states? Justice Anthony Kennedy, a Republican appointed by Ronald Reagan, wrote the majority opinion in the 5-4 ruling joined by the court's four liberal justices. "No union is more profound than marriage," he wrote, "for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family." As for same-sex couples, he added, "Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right." In a rare move, four conservative justices each penned their own dissent. Chief Justice Roberts' dissent told those who favor same-sex marriage to by all means celebrate today's decision, but he added, "Do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it." Justice Antonin Scalia called the court's action a threat to American democracy. Support for gay marriage, however, has grown across the nation, with same-sex marriage bans remaining in place in only 13 states before this ruling. A recent Pew Research poll showed 57% of Americans surveyed now support same-sex marriage, including nearly two-thirds of Democrats and independents, but only one-third of Republicans. Republican presidential candidates spoke out against the ruling. Religious conservative Mike Huckabee called it judicial tyranny. Florida Governor Jeb Bush, a frontrunner for the GOP nomination, stated, "I believe in traditional marriage. I believe the Supreme Court should have allowed the states to make this decision. I also believe that we should love our neighbor and respect others, including those making lifetime commitments. In a country as diverse as ours, good people who have opposing views should be able to live side by side." Outside the Supreme Court, thousands rallied, most in favor of legalization of same-sex marriage. Upon hearing the news, a gay men's chorus celebrated with a moving rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner, which the White House promptly posted on its website blog. While the ruling legalizes same-sex marriages across the nation, it does not compel churches to perform such ceremonies, but merely protects the rights of individuals to obtain marriage licenses and have a ceremony performed by state, county, or local officials or a willing private party. San Diego Democratic Party Chair Francine Busby issued this statement. As Democrats who cherish equality as a fundamental value, we are inspired, elated, and proud anytime the ongoing struggle for civil rights in our country results in a victory like this. But, she added, there are still many battles ahead. In most states, you can still be fired for being gay or transgender. Outdated adoption laws still need to be fixed to enable more families to thrive. The movement will not stop today, she said. But in this Pride Month on this historic day, we are happy to celebrate with the LGBT community in San Diego County and across the nation, Busby concluded. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
In the wake of the massacre at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina last week, a conversation about rejecting the Confederate flag has risen to the national level. 21-year-old gunman Dylan Roof walked into a Bible study group and opened fire in the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, killing 9 people. Authorities say that he targeted the individuals because they were black. Roof, a white supremacist, displayed a Confederate flag in photos online and on his vehicle. After the news broke, a national outcry went out for the victims and their families. Religious leaders across the country held prayer vigils to show their support. Reverend Leslie White, a pastor at Bethel Memorial African Methodist Episcopal Church, the oldest historical black church in San Diego, held a prayer vigil in support of the victims and their families. The actions of Roof have also sparked a national debate about the Confederate flag, largely known as a symbol of the slavery era in the South. Supporters of the flag say it pays tribute to the fallen soldiers during the Civil War and represent America's history in the South, but opponents say it symbols of hate and racist motives during the protests of the Civil Rights Movement. According to the New York Times, lawmakers from South Carolina are planning a proposal to remove the Confederate flag from the grounds of the Capitol, as campaigns against Confederate symbols spread in other states. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley made the call Monday afternoon for the removal of the Confederate flag from the State House grounds. The flag, previously removed from atop the State Capitol building, has in recent years flown at a war memorial on state property outside the Capitol. Leading retailers Walmart, Amazon, eBay, Target, and Sears all announced bans on the sale of Confederate flag merchandise amid an intensifying national debate over the use of the controversial flag. After Haley's announcement, political leaders from both major political parties have voiced their matter on the issue. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker tweeted, "I am glad Nikki Haley is calling out for the Confederate flag to come down. I support her decision." Former Texas Governor Rick Perry, who initially said the incident was an accident, later issued a statement that he supported Haley's decision, saying it honors the peoples of Charleston and the families of the victims of last week's horrific hate crime. Removing the flag is an act of healing and unity that allows us to find a shared purpose based on the values that unify us. May God continue to be with the families of the victims in Charleston and the great people of South Carolina. Chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, stated that this is just the beginning of a conversation we as a society need to have about race, bigotry, and violence in this country, not the end of one. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Joanne Armstrong.
This is Miriam Raftery with a special report from East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. The massacre of 9 people at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, by an avowed white supremacist has drawn national attention to the issue of hate crimes. But just how prevalent are racially motivated hate crimes here in our region? East County Magazine requested public records to examine hate crime statistics in California and San Diego County and to learn how our region compares to the nation overall. In 2013, the last year for which the FBI has data available, San Diego had 73 hate crimes, or about 1/100th of the total hate crimes in the U.S., consistent with our county's percentage of the total U.S. population. But 57%, well over half of the local hate crimes, were racially motivated, and that's higher than the national average. Nationwide, 5,928 hate crimes were reported in 2013. Of those, almost half of them, 48.5%, were racially motivated, and two-thirds of the racial incidents across the country targeted African Americans. Another 20% of hate crimes were based on sexual orientation of the victims. Nearly 17% of victims were targeted based on religion, and the overwhelming majority of religious-based hate crimes, 59% of them, targeted Jews. Just over 11% of hate crimes were based on ethnicity, with Hispanics the targets in 53% of those cases. Disabilities accounted for 1% of the nation's hate crimes, while gender and gender identity comprised a 0.5% each. A quarter of the hate crimes involved property damage or vandalism. Another 28% involved intimidation. The rest were violent attacks, including assaults, rapes, and 6 murders. 1 in every 7 hate crimes in the United States occurred in California, which had 833 hate crimes in 2013. That is consistent with the national rate, since California has about 1/8 of the entire U.S. population. These stats include only crimes reported as hate incidents by law enforcement agencies, so if there is bias within any of the agencies in any areas of the U.S., reporting in some places could be low. In San Diego County, 73 hate crimes were reported in the same time period. Of those 73 cases countywide, most of them, 42, were due to racial bias. A dozen were due to sexual orientation, followed by 10 cases based on religion and 9 based on ethnicity. 43 of the 73 local cases were in the city of San Diego, with another 13 in the unincorporated areas of the county. Escondido and Oceanside each had 7 reported hate crimes. Among East County cities, Santee had 3, Lemon Grove and El Cajon had 2 each, and La Mesa reported none. In the city of San Diego, 18 of those 43 reported hate crimes were racially motivated, with 12 each motivated by religious or sexual orientation bias and 1 by ethnicity. In the unincorporated areas of the county, which includes parts of East County, nearly half of the 13 hate crimes were racially motivated. Among East County communities, El Cajon had 1 hate crime that was motivated by race and the other by ethnicity. Lemon Grove's 2 hate crimes were spurred by racial and sexual orientation, while Santee had 1 crime each motivated by race, sexual orientation, and ethnicity. While many Californians and San Diegans take pride in our region's diversity, it is clear that there are still strides to be made to improve racial relations, tolerance, and safety for all people in our region, regardless of their origins or their beliefs.
This is DeVario Bell reporting for our East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. The Summit Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is taking a stand locally against racism and prejudice. The group held a Standing on the Side of Love movement on June 22nd in Lemon Grove to support the Black Lives Matter movement. According to a press release issued by the event organizer Jack Hsu, the movement is a cry for help regarding tactics taken by police officers nationwide, plus a criminal justice system that exhibits flagrantly disproportionate acts of violence, incrimination, and incarceration of blacks of America. Event demonstrators advocated for local law enforcement agencies, such as the San Diego Sheriff's Department, to stop conducting actions like Operation Lemon Drop, which critics say seem to focus on low-income populations of color. Operation Lemon Drop involves officers targeting trolley riders, checking for parole and probation violations. This was a second rally in East San Diego County, sponsored by the Summit Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, supporting the Black Lives Matter movement. The Summit Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is based in Santee.
Supporters of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, scored a major victory before the Supreme Court this week. The High Court issued a landmark ruling to uphold nationwide federal subsidies in all 50 states to help people buy health care under Obamacare. Opponents argued that the subsidies should be available only to people in states that set up health care exchanges. Currently, 8.7 million Americans receive the subsidies, but the vast majority of those, 6.4 million of them, are in states that never set up exchanges. Those 6.4 million people would have lost their subsidies if plaintiffs had prevailed in the case, King versus Burrell. Chief Justice John Roberts voted with liberal justices to support the law. Writing the majority decision, Roberts concluded, "Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not destroy them." He added that limiting subsidies only to states with their own exchanges, such as California, could send insurance markets in other states into a death spiral. About 3 dozen states do not have health care exchanges, mostly red Republican-controlled states. Justice Antonin Scalia issued a scathing dissent, calling the court majority's interpretation unheard of. President Barack Obama issued a statement praising the court's decision to uphold the law, which passed Congress without a single Republican vote. "We've got more to do, but what we're not going to do is unravel what has now been woven into the fabric of America," the president said. But Republican leaders in Congress have pledged to continue their fight against the law, which even many supporters concede has flaws. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, challenged Democrats to work with us to address the ongoing negative impacts of the law. One of those negative impacts was the exodus from the health care market by some companies, forcing many of their insured customers to pay higher rates. The president's promise that consumers who liked their health care could keep it proved inaccurate in those cases. Shares of publicly traded hospitals shot up after the high court's decision, now that investors don't have to worry that patients may drop coverage without subsidies, an action that could have sent a wave of suddenly uninsured people to hospital emergency rooms. Ben Nelson, the CEO of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, said the high court's ruling will allow state officials to move forward with a level of confidence that their markets will not see significant disruption. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The controversial fast-tracking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership International Trade Pact passed the Senate by a slim one-vote margin. California's Senator Dianne Feinstein voted for the fast-tracking, while Senator Barbara Boxer voted no. Fast-tracking gives President Obama broad latitude to negotiate the trade pact, after which Congress will have only an up or down vote with no opportunity to make changes. Opponents have voiced concerns over secrecy of the proceedings. The proposed pact has not been made public, nor have members of Congress been allowed to have copies. Nicole Callie Gotchmanowski, Southern California organizer for the Citizens Trade Campaign, a group opposed to fast-tracking the TPP, had this to say about the extensive media coverage of the vote and the protests targeting Senator Feinstein's office here in San Diego. "People are hearing that she voted for fast track with no support from workers who will lose their jobs, or those concerned about weakened human rights provisions, or being handcuffed on any negotiations on climate change action, or nurses concerned with access to medicine, or many others for many more reasons," Gotchmanowski stated. The Trade Promotion Authority measure that authorizes fast-tracking of the TPP has also passed the House of Representatives. Among San Diego's congressional representatives, only Republican Duncan Hunter voted no. Republican Daryl Issa joined with Democrats Scott Peters and Susan Davis to vote yes, while Democrat Juan Vargas did not vote. Congresswoman Davis, in an email to constituents, offered this justification of her vote. "While I understand the potential downsides," Davis said, "I ultimately supported TPA to allow President Obama to continue his efforts to negotiate trade agreements that strengthen America's economy, improve national security, and protect workers and the environment." She said she also supported the measure because it guarantees the public and Congress maintain the right to review any future trade agreements for set amounts of time before they are signed and before any vote comes to the floor of the House. Congressman Hunter, in a letter urging the House Majority Leader not to muscle through the fast-track bill, voiced concerns that it could allow the president to add other countries, such as China, or to change labor provisions. In addition, Hunter voiced concerns that the Trans-Pacific Partnership Commission to be formed would diminish the sovereignty of the United States. He wrote, "The new commission would be a self-governing, continuing body authorized to issue policies and regulations affecting our economy, our manufacturers, our workers, our immigration procedures, as well as currency, labor, and environmental practices. It is one thing to exchange executive authority with respect to a narrow set of trade policies," Hunter concluded. "It is another to fast-track the creation of a new international structure before a single detail about that structure has been made available to the public." Congressman Peters acknowledged good arguments on both sides, but in a letter sent to his constituents, he wrote, "Our economy, both in San Diego and across the country, depend on trade. Our biotech and high-tech companies depend on exporting their goods, and as a port city, San Diego depends on access to foreign markets." But Peters concluded, "Trade only works if we set the rules. If we don't step up, someone else, like China, will. We need to set the standard for how the global market operates. If we don't, we risk the system being rigged against us to the detriment of American workers."
This is DeVario Bell with an update on severe wildfire conditions across the western United States. As firefighters battle wildfires across four western states, Cal Fire officials have warned that this fourth year of drought has resulted in California's worst fire conditions on record. As of now, Cal Fire is fighting 7 major wildfires in our state. Speaking Monday at a kickoff for Wildfire Awareness Week in Pollock Pines, the scene of last year's devastating 97,000-acre King Fire, Cal Fire Chief Ken Pimlott stated that due to dry fuel conditions, we'll be reaching records for potential heat output, which means that more and more severe wildfires are happening earlier in the year than would normally occur. The water shortage has left more vegetation, including lawns, dry. The drought also means fire departments need to conserve water too. Firefighters are doing more dry mopping up of blazes, and some departments are recycling water used in training exercises, according to an article in Reporting San Diego. Across the West, firefighters have been battling major blazes in the past week in soaring summer temperatures. In California, these include 7 fires, notably the Washington Fire in Alpine County's Humboldt-Toyabe National Forest, that has scorched over 16,000 acres and was only 5% contained as of midweek. The Lake Fire in San Bernardino Mountains north of San Diego has ravaged more than 1,800 acres and is still only partially contained. A wildfire sparked by lightning in Oregon charred thousands of acres south of Cave Junction on the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, where thousands of firefighters have been working to battle the blaze. In Washington State, a wildfire caused by lightning smoldered for days in Olympic National Park before it was discovered. It has since spread into towering mountains and rugged terrain. Alaska is the scene of multiple mass fires that have forced evacuations in rural Eskimo villages, burned 12 square miles near Nanaimo, and charred additional acreage near Fairbanks and Juneau. Firefighters in Alaska face special perils. One was bitten by a bear in Chugach National Park, but fortunately suffered only minor injuries.
This is Ed Barreno with a weather report. Thunderstorms capable of heavy downpours, gusty winds, and lightning strikes may hit our mountain and desert regions starting this weekend. The storms are forecast from Saturday through Tuesday, mainly in the afternoons and evenings. The National Weather Service warns of potentially frequent deadly lightning strikes and cautions when thunder roars go indoors. Avoid ridgelines, lakes, pools, or other bodies of water and stay away from tall objects that can attract a lightning strike. While a drenching would be good for bringing water to our drought-parched region, lightning and high winds also mean increased fire danger. Firefighters across the state are already spread thin, battling numerous blazes in other counties, so it's especially important to make sure you've cleared brush to provide defensible space around your home and avoid any activities that could cause a fire, such as improperly discarding cigarettes or using a weed whacker during hot, dry conditions when sparks could ignite dry brush. A no-burn order remains in effect for all areas protected by Cal Fire, meaning no burning leaves, trash, or campfires, except in designated campfire rings and authorized campgrounds.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Pope Francis has issued a rare encyclical urging a global revolution to address climate change. An encyclical is one of the Church's most authoritative teaching documents, traditionally addressed to the 1 billion Catholics worldwide. But this time, the Pope says his message is aimed at every person living on this planet to save our common home. The Pope warned that doomsday predictions can no longer be met with irony or disdain. He criticized modern society's addiction to fossil fuels, technology worship, and consumerism, trends that he views as reckless actions that have pushed our planet to the breaking point. A former teacher, Pope Francis issued persuasive arguments calling for drastic changes to embrace sustainability, including specific actions such as recycling, improving public transit, and protecting our environment. He asked, what kind of world do we want to leave to those who come after us, to children who are now growing up? The 184-page document draws on the works of dozens of scientists, theologians, scholars from a wide range of fields, and previous popes. To the faithful, Pope Francis issued this reminder, we are not God. The earth was here before us and has been given to us. A Pew Research poll just released found that 7 in 10 Catholics in the U.S. believe the planet is getting warmer, and almost half believe that man's actions are responsible, and that climate change is a serious problem. That faith splits down party lines, however, with 80% of Catholic Democrats and only half of Catholic Republicans agreeing that global warming is even occurring. The Pope's call for action drew mostly praise from world leaders outside of the U.S., including the current and past Secretary Generals of the United Nations. Former Secretary General Kofi Annan said he applauds the Pope for his strong moral and ethical leadership, concluding that more such leadership is needed. But he asked, will we see it at the climate summit in Paris? Here in the U.S., the Pope's action has drawn strong reactions among presidential candidates and other politicians. Florida Governor Jeb Bush, a Catholic who declared his candidacy for the presidency last week, stated dismissively, I don't get economic policies from my bishops or my cardinals or my pope. I think religion ought to be about making us better as people and less about things that end up getting in the political realm. Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, another Republican presidential candidate, suggested that the church would be better off leaving science to the scientists and focusing on what we're really good at, which is theology and morality. Santorum apparently was unaware that Pope Francis actually holds a degree in chemistry from a school in Buenos Aires. On the heels of the Pope's call for action on climate change, The Lancet, one of the world's most respected medical journals, issued a report by the 2015 Lancet Commission on Health and Climate Change. It concludes that climate change poses a severe threat to public health worldwide. Democratic presidential campaign frontrunner Hillary Clinton, former First Lady and Secretary of State, sent a tweet stating she believes the Pope is right, adding, climate change is a moral crisis that disproportionately harms the neediest among us. We need leadership, not denial. California Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat and the ranking member of the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate, issued a press release which states, the Lancet report reaffirms once again that we must take steps that will allow us to protect the health of our children and families worldwide. Climate change deniers in Congress need to stop ignoring the serious repercussions of unmitigated climate change, the senator said, such as extreme heat and weather events, and work with us to reduce dangerous pollution and address this serious threat to public health.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson
and Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Ed Barena.
This week's Destination East County includes Gold Rush Days in Julian, outdoor movies, and a preview of coming attractions, including 4th of July festivities, Mary Poppins on Mount Helix, and the annual Descanso Days Fair and Parade. So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more.
Summer movies in the park are back at Viejas Outlet Center in Alpine, complete with comfy outdoor seating, popcorn, and soda for a nominal admission fee. Kids under 12 have free admission. Next up, Dolphin Tale 2 is screening on Friday, June 26th, followed by Finding Nemo on Saturday, June 27th. Gates open at 7 with showtime at sunset around 8 p.m.
Experience the history of the Old West with costumed hosts who interpret what life was like in the California mining camp in the 1880s during the Julian Gold Rush days on June 27th and 28th. There are activities throughout the town. The Eagle High Peak Mine and Museum, one of the more prosperous mines during the Gold Rush, will be offering mine tours, museum tours, and gold panning. There will also be historical encampments featuring miners, mountain men, and cowboys, plus gunfighting, reenactments, mock claim jumping, and tomahawk throwing. Plus enjoy an arts and crafts market, gem mining, and children's pioneer games. Also be on the lookout for the Golden Nugget at participating stores in Julian to join a scavenger hunt. The folks at Julian Train and Gold Mine Tour at Smith Ranch will offer a special train ride. Julian Doves and Desperados will present historic comedy skits in the stage between Julian Fitness Center and the Julian Market. Julian Mining Company on Highway 78 will have gold panning and square dancing, plus opportunities to learn woodcrafting, pottery making, or make your own crafts. For details on all of these events, you can visit julianca.com.
The annual Heritage Quilt Show, presented by the Julian Women's Club, will be located upstairs in the Julian Town Hall on June 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. On display will be quilts from as far back as the 1800s, many treasured from local families' ancestors. A beautiful king-size quilt made collectively by local quilters will be raffled off, with the winner announced on July 4th. There will also be handmade items for sale at the event.
And now for a preview of coming attractions. Julian hosts its all-day 4th of July celebration from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Independence Day, including a flyover at 11 a.m. and a parade that rolls out at noon down Main Street, plus musical talent and entertainment. And after the parade, there will be a barbecue and music at the American Legion for a fee.
El Cajon invites you to celebrate Independence Day with games, musical entertainment, and fireworks at the City of El Cajon's 4th of July celebration. On Independence Day, the El Cajon Recreation Department will once again have a celebration event at Kennedy Park, located at 1675 East Madison Avenue in El Cajon. The fun starts with carnival games, an inflatable jump, kiddie train, and skate park from 1 p.m. to 8 p.m. There will also be free crafts and family games from 2 to 6. Two live bands will play, followed by the finale, a 9 p.m. fireworks show with synchronized music.
The City of Santee will host its annual Santee Salutes 4th of July celebration at Town Center Community Park from 3:30 to 10 p.m. on Independence Day. The festivities include live music featuring 80s All-Stars, a patriotic ceremony at 6 p.m., a kids' fun zone, and a spectacular fireworks display at 9 p.m.
Can you say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious? Christian Community Theater San Diego is celebrating its 35th anniversary at this beautiful Mount Helix Park Amphitheater with this summer's production of Mary Poppins. Enjoy an evening with everyone's favorite nanny from July 9th through August 2nd. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit cctsandiego.org.
The 46th annual Descanso Days annual parade and fair will roll out on July 11th starting at 10 a.m. on Viejas Grade in Descanso. Sponsored by the Descanso Town Hall Association, the parade features a flyover by the vintage World War II aircraft fighter planes from Gillespie Field, followed by a parade with vintage cars and tractors, horses and riders, and more. After the parade, the Just Friends Bluegrass Band will perform, followed by the Nitro Express Western Band. The day's festivities will also include dancing, contests, children's games, and Western reenactments by the Grand Ladies of the Old West, ending at 6 p.m.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org. If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor at eastcountymagazine.org.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Sherry Kephart, author of the upcoming memoir, A Few Minor Adjustments, which was placed in San Diego Writers, Inc. first annual Memoir Writers Competition. Along with a select group of other memoirs, A Few Minor Adjustments will be showcased by professional actors at the Horton Grand Theater on Tuesday, June 30th. Welcome, Sherry. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you, Raina. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with a snapshot of your story. I know that you longed for adventure. You traveled the world from the remote villages of Central Africa to New Zealand until a mysterious illness brought you to the precipice of death. Yet your memoir is comical and tragic. How do you balance that in telling such a powerful story?
I think it's very important to inject humor in our life and our stories because we all have tragedies. We all go through really difficult things. And when I first wrote my book, it was very dark and very serious. It was very cathartic to write. Mm-hmm. However, I was depressed reading it, and I thought, who's going to want to read that? So I said, you know what? It's like when you go on a traveling adventure, and all these crazy, weird things happen.
Right.
And not really great things. And then you come back, and you tell the stories to your friends, and they're really funny.
Right, in retrospect.
In retrospect. So then you're like, then I thought about it. I thought, you know, I'm going to inject that humor throughout my book. And help give people a little bit of breath during these tragedies that you read about that happened to me.
Right.
And interestingly enough, it actually helped me kind of rewrite the bad things that happen to me in my mind and my soul. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like they're not such bad things. Like, I look back at them with humor now and insight that I never had before until I wrote this book. So I feel really, really happy about that.
Can you give us an example of something that's poignant and funny the way in the telling?
Absolutely. I had a heart procedure, mm-hmm. and which no one wants to go through.
Right.
And it was a very, you know, nerve-wracking day, and I was very scared. And so I'm on the table strapped down like Frankenstein's monster, you know, right. with all these electrodes and devices, and there's mm-hmm. people scurrying back and forth, and there's bright light shining on me in this room, and I'm like, wow, they're going to go in and just, you know, do things to my heart. You know, that's not good. And there's a nurse. She comes up to me, one of the cardiac nurses, and she comes up and looks, leans over me and says, you know, I have your condition too, but I'm too scared to do the procedure.
Really?
And I was like, what? You're telling me this now? So I looked at her and I could barely move my head because I'm strapped down. And uh-huh. I said, well, you know, you can see I obviously made the decision to go through with it. So maybe you'll be able to get more courage after you see mm-hmm. what happens with me.
Yeah.
And she goes, oh, you're right. Thank you. And I was thinking to myself, isn't she supposed to be comforting me? Right?
So you did her therapy.
Yeah, I did her therapy. And so I look back now, that was not funny at the time right. for me, but now I think that's kind of funny.
Yeah. So ironic.
It's ironic.
Yeah. Well, I know that you started out as a Peace Corps volunteer in Zambia. Tell us what that was like for a Venice Beach girl.
It was shocking. I mean, there's no way around it. You go from California with beaches and very affluent cultures and, you know, everything at our fingertips, whether you have money or not, it's mm-hmm. there and it's available and you see it. We mm-hmm. have, and you go to a place where there's death and disease and desolation and corruption and on everywhere you turn. And yet these people are some of the happiest, nicest, sincerest people you'll ever meet. And so
it's amazing.
I have goosebumps right now just remembering mm-hmm. the integrity and soul of these people. It's just, it's beautiful. And they had nothing. And yet they were willing to give everything they had to me. But what was interesting to me, it was the most shocking part of my experience was coming home.
Right.
I thought it would be going there. Mm-hmm. But when you come back, you're transformed in a way that most people who have never been to a place like that can ever understand. Mm-hmm. And so I had to readjust my thinking to living in the privilege that we have living here in the United States and understand that. And there's a responsibility with that to mm-hmm. live your life with gratitude, live your life with insight and share it with others. So the people that aren't able to travel to those remote places and see what's going on, to really help them understand and, make this world a better place, really, because of what I've experienced. And that's one of my goals with the book, is to mm-hmm. shed light on that other side of life.
Now, what kind of work were you doing in the Peace Corps? Because I know that's where you first got sick.
Yes. We were the first group of Peace Corps volunteers to go to Zambia. And we were doing a water and sanitation health education project. So we were building wells and latrines. And it was hard labor in like really, really hot sun and difficult conditions. You know, there was no electricity, no running water, no creature comforts of any kind. So we were really living in remote places like the locals do. And it was very harsh.
And so what made you choose this?
I wanted to help people. I mean, I always had that dream and my mother instilled that into me. We did a lot of volunteer work as kids in my mm-hmm. house, helping other people. And so that was a really thing I always wanted to keep in my life, but I also always longed for adventure. I wanted to explore the world and see how other people lived and mm-hmm. what they were doing, because there's so much, mm-hmm. you know, there's so much outside of ourselves.
Right. And you certainly got adventure.
I definitely, I got more than I asked for. Right. Absolutely.
I know that for years your illness, it baffled medical specialists and new age specialists. What kept you going through all of it? I know that you reached bottom many times. So what kept you going?
There were so many things. First and foremost, you have to have a love for life. If you don't have a strong will to live, you'd give up a long time ago. So I fortunately had that. I always had this amazing zest for living on every level. So I wanted to get back to restored health so I could do things again, so I could be a part of the world. But more than that, it was love. You know, I had love from my family, my friends, my boyfriend at the time, who stayed by my side throughout the whole thing. What an amazing man. And then everybody in the medical profession who went to bat for me and never gave up. You know, there were so many people that were baffled and didn't know what to do with me. Yet there was others that were persistent and said, let's figure this out. And if I don't know the answer, I'll direct you to someone that does.
Mm. For all those people out there who have an ailment and don't really, that hasn't been diagnosed, that they don't know what it is, would you have any words of wisdom for them?
Absolutely. No matter how bad your day is this day and how insurmountable it seems, the next day can be better. So hold on, find that glimmer and spark of light in mm-hmm. each dark moment, and there might just be something for you the next day.
So I guess that's what you meant on your Facebook page when you say that you received more than just a diagnosis from your adventure, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. There's always something more than what's happening to us. We mm-hmm. may not see it in the moment, but our biggest tragedies, the biggest darkness in our life, I think yields the best, most beautiful lessons in love and light.
So are you excited to see parts of your story being played out on stage?
Yes, I am. I'm so excited. This is a dream come true. And I look forward to making people laugh, inspiring people, helping people. It's absolutely a dream.
Do you have any concerns or doubts of how the actress will portray some of the experiences in your illness and story?
I don't have any doubts. I saw this, in the rehearsals. Uh-huh. Everything's going well. I do have concerns that I might be branded with some of the unique things that are shown in this showcase, which I will not tell you or
no,
give away.
Don't give the spoiler.
But let me just say this. It's quite unique. And everybody that has seen any part of this so far just says, wow. So, yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting.
Well, congratulations on winning that.
Thank you.
One last question. With your memoir complete, and it's going to be launched in the world this year, what's next for you? What are you writing now?
I have so many things I want to write, and I'm so excited. One of the things I'm working on is a cookbook. Hmm. It's called The Cookbook for People Who Can't Eat Anything. It is a humorous and comprehensive account of someone like me who's gone through a lot of health struggles and finds that they have a lot of allergies, sensitivities to food. And so, you know, it's just about clean eating, healthy eating, but with a twist, a lot of humor in it, a lot of fun. I want to have fun with it, but helping people like me who think they really can't eat anything, there's so much you can't eat. So that's one of the things I'm working on.
So you've become an expert on food as well.
I don't know about an expert, but close to it, yes.
Okay, well, our time is up, Sherry, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And enjoy your show. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
For more information on Sherry Kephart and her work, please visit her Facebook page at facebook.com/Sherry.Kephart, and that's KEPHART.author. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guests are from the Philippines. They are here with the International Visitor Leadership Program brought here by the State Department. I'd like to introduce Catherine Roja Raimundo, who is a reporter with the Center for Media Freedom and Responsibility, and Nelson Victorino, who is an attorney with the Filipino Senate. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
It's a pleasure, Miriam.
Can you tell me a little bit about this mission that has brought you here to the United States?
Actually, the U.S. Embassy invited us to take part in this program. There are eight representatives from mostly from government agencies, different government agencies, and one like here, Catherine, is the only participant from the civil society. So we were selected maybe because of our own work that we do in the Philippines in connection with corruption, transparency, and the freedom of information.
Very important. So what have you been learning? You've been all around the United States, and I understand that San Diego is your last stop. What has made the biggest impression on you? Give us some examples of what you've learned.
We've been going around. We've been to D.C., New York, New Hampshire, New Orleans, and as you have said, San Diego is our last stop. Our program mostly is about the anti-corruption, reducing corruption programs of the U.S. government from federal level to the state level.
So you're looking to see what works here that could perhaps be emulated in the Philippines, or I understand corruption is a problem there as it sometimes is here.
Correct. We've been looking at the best practices to reduce corruption. So we've been discussing about the FOI Act in the
Freedom
US,
of Information
the Freedom of Information Act. Some of the offices that assures transparency and accountability in government, like the Government Ethics, Government Accountability Office, and the Inspector General and your Department of Justice.
Yeah, that's correct. We would like to see the best practices in governance from the federal level to the local level. So mostly in our engagements with all these various government agencies, one common factor that we mostly agreed on is that the level of salary that the public officer or public employee gets is a very, very good it's a very important factor that may deter a commission of corruption.
In other words,
in government
the
office.
Higher the salaries, the more apt people are to.
Yes, but we were surprised when we got to New Hampshire and we found out that members of Congress and the House of Representatives and the senators only get $100 a year.
Wow.
And
so there's no incentive
there's no
to run for the
there's
office
no
for money.
Yes.
You have to just
so
love what you're doing.
It totally debunks the previous mindset that we got from all the previous engagements. So it's kind of interesting.
Very interesting. Now, I understand, Nelson, that you have been working on trying to get a Freedom of Information Act passed for some time in the Philippines. Can you tell us how that's going?
Well, actually, my principal, the senator, just got elected in 2013. She's on her first term.
Mm-hmm.
But she's the chairman of the Committee on Public Information, and on her campaign, she promised that she would push through for the passage of the Freedom of Information Act, which has languished in the legislative archives for the last 28 years. And fortunately, with the help of civil society groups in the media, like Catherine's group, we were able to have it passed in the Senate in record time in 4 months, but still, our problem is the lower house. So hopefully, this Congress will end next year around June. We hope that we could have it passed after 28 years.
Very good. Are there any elements that you have in the Philippines that you would consider good governance practices that we could perhaps learn from here?
I think, speaking about independence and autonomy, most of our laws, I would say, are very good laws. We have problems of implementation or enforcement of laws.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good help that we see how government in the U.S. operates, because we can learn from that.
Actually, right now, we look up to the United States model and in the implementation as a benchmark. It's something that's really much better than ours. And I think one good thing to know is you're no different than our country, but only we can really see that the crooks, those who are guilty of committing corruption, are really tried in a much faster pace and cases concluded and they're in jail.
Yeah, you mentioned that one of the cases you've looked at here was the Randy Cunningham case.
Yes.
Interesting.
We have a similar case too, where the media took an active role in looking at corruption cases, and that's our 10 billion pork barrel fund that's just discovered. But we also want to do the Cunningham case where you were able to prosecute him. we only have, we're still in the investigation phase and filing the trial, we're still in the trial, like looking at the, our evidence. So, but we have jailed three senators, sitting senators. They're in jail now and undergoing trial. But, you know, we would like to see resolutions such as the Cunningham case where we really prosecute. And most, I think for me, the important thing is getting back the property, the forfeiture, because that's taxpayers'
what
money.
What they stole.
Yeah, so I think that's more important. Because
that's actually a breakthrough because we've had two past presidents who've been jailed for corruption charges. And now we have three sitting elected senators who are also in jail.
So these are similar offenses. You are having some accountability down there at the very highest levels then.
Yeah. But you would like to see that all corrupt officials from up there down to the bottom will be made accountable for their shenanigans.
Catherine, what was the key to holding presidents accountable and getting them behind bars in your country? That's quite amazing.
Well, the media is a very big help. They started the investigation, exposing the wrongdoings of these officials. And that's why we've been pushing precisely for the Freedom of Information Act, because we see it as an anti-corruption tool that the media and the public can use to help make the government work for the people and not for self-interest.
There you go. What was the most surprising thing that you found in your travels around the United States looking into this?
What's surprising is the realization that ours is not much different from the things that happen here.
Yeah.
Especially corruption in high levels, going down to those in the cities and counties. So what really inspires us to is really how to set up institutional mechanisms that would work without need for media to expose these things.
Yeah.
That we can work to go after these crooks without waiting for media to unearth.
You've mentioned too about the implementation of laws that would help prevent and discourage corruption from happening in the first place. Can you give us an example or two of that?
The Freedom of Information Act is one. Secondly, there's a bill that's, I think that has been filed for government agencies to automatically upload all documents, voluntarily. Mm-hmm. So that it's an open data system.
What kind of a campaign finance system do you have down there? Is it similar to here where we have these, you know, massive donations going into political campaigns that gives the wealthy and corporations a very huge influence, labor unions and so
forth?
We
do, but we do have the reporting of financial disclosures. We do have that. But I think what we've learned here is you're more proactive in terms of getting that disclosures, because you do it before the campaign, mm-hmm. during the campaign, and after the campaign. In the Philippines, we usually do it after.
It's a little too late.
What happens is you get donors who wouldn't want their names reflected in the documents, and then some guys will look for willing dummies to lend their names and to ingratiate themselves with the the elected officials just to have their names written on the reports.
Very
so it's after the fact.
Yeah,
and I like the idea that your citizens or in your communities are very active.
I was just going to ask you about that. How important is citizen engagement in keeping corruption under control or preventing it?
We've been to different cities and different states, and we found that your volunteerism is very active and very engaged. We also saw several civil society organizations that have been working closely with the government and with different stakeholders that want to do programs that are about transparency and accountability. And those are the things that we'd like to emulate in the Philippines, you know, push for more engagement from the citizens, because they will be the watchdog.
Yeah.
Watchdogs.
They are. The watchdogs of democracy. We've certainly had many examples here where ordinary citizens brought us stories. They saw some wrongdoing. They came forward and it came out
in
media.
In the Philippines, there are volunteer organizations who are into that. They're really watchdogs, but not too many groups. And because of our, I said the implementation of criminal laws, that the culture of impunity is there, that these whistleblowers are really, their lives are really in danger from politicians, and the protection, the institutional protection that's afforded them is not really in place.
So that's another thing you'd like to go home and maybe implement, would be stronger protections.
That's why whenever we talk to agencies about investigating
corruption
in all levels of government, and we always they get surprised. They're surprised whenever we ask them that, were you threatened by somebody, by these politicians that you're investigating, or did somebody die or get shot?
Yeah.
Because it's a common thing in the Philippines, especially in the provinces.
Well, I had a story some years ago where I was investigating an issue of election integrity, electronic voting machines that had been tampered with. And I had a very high-level whistleblower inside the Diebold election machine company that had told me basically exactly how elections were being rigged. And he was very afraid to speak because someone else who'd spoken on the same issue had come home and found his dog's throat slit, and, you know, a clear warning of not to speak out when he had spoken to media. And I did have a DA in Georgia or whatever state it was come after me wanting me to reveal this guy's name, and I just refused. I said, you'd have to put me in jail to do it. I'm not going to, you know, disclose this source, and they never pursued it further, thankfully. We do have also, there's encryption software and things like that in the U.S. I used to write for a national level media outlet, and there was actually an encrypted program where government whistleblowers could go on and they could leak documents and they could hook up with reporters and you could interview them and verify who they were, but supposedly nobody else could. I don't know now with the NSA if they're reading it all or have figured out how to crack that, but that was another level of protection that was available back then to some of the whistleblowers.
It's something that maybe we should consider.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have the Whistleblowers Act is still pending before Congress, just like our FOI law. So, yeah, we do have to work on that.
Yeah. I'm going to give the two of you the final say here. What else have you learned that you would like to share with our listeners here on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice?
Yeah, one of our discussions just recently talked about corruption is opportunity-based. And I think we do agree with that. And in the Philippines, as well as here, we want to minimize those opportunities. And that would be the program that we will think about going back to the country.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I find it admirable. And these public integrity offices in the cities, that the cities we went to, where we admire their programs, the integrity of the officers that run that particular section. And I hope that our local governments would come up with such programs. And I think it will start with our leaders who will get elected, that if they really show that they're not really honest and in their deeds and their words, that they also appear to be honest. I think it will start a movement. It will be a strong, fresh wind that will sway the people into doing the same things and supporting the same initiatives for more honest, open and governance.
Yeah. Honest, transparent government is certainly something that I think all citizens deserve around the world. And it's very encouraging to see the work that you're doing here to try to bring more of that to the Philippines and also educating people here in the United States about some of these issues. I want to thank both of you for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam. It's our pleasure.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, A.K. Jules, Brian Boyko,
royalty-free music. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.